This is Sounding Board Parenting, creating healthier human connections through the commonality of parenting, exploring the world of parenting with high-performing mums and dads from a range of backgrounds, industries, and family dynamics.
He said, the whole world looks different.
You can do it your way.
My life has been fundamentally altered by their existence.
I gotta tell you, kids don't stop learning.
That is how I change the story.
Babies are instant community generators.
My growth curve just like shot up after I had a kid.
I wasn't planning any of it.
Let's jump in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Sounding Board Parenting Podcast. We have an absolutely awesome chat lined up for you in today's episode. Awesome to have you here on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join you for the chat.
I'm really looking forward to diving into this with you. And before we deep dive into the world of parenting, we always like our guests to be able to just introduce themselves, tell us a bit about yourself and the names and ages of your children too.
Yeah, so my name's Hugh Van Kylenberg. I am the founding director of the Resilience Project. So we run programs in schools, in businesses, in sporting clubs all around the country to try and help try and help people experience the best positive mental health they can and to be as happy as possible, I guess. I have two kids. I have a 3.5-year-old called Benji, who at the moment is just absolutely divine. However, having said that, the last year and a half has been, like, everyone told us about the terrible twos. We knew about that, but no one told us what happened when he turned 3. And oh my God, complete psychopath for 6 months. And all of a sudden he's just clicked and he's lovely. And we also have a little girl. Her name is Elsie. And if I look and sound tired today, it's because of her. It was last night was a rough one. She's turning 6 months old today.
Wow, 6 months old. I'm interested to dive into that a little bit further in terms of that transition from one child to two. What's that been like for yourself and Penny?
We asked a lot of people how hard it is because we were finding one really difficult. Like, we found one so hard, and I kept saying to Penny, I don't know, like, when she was pregnant, I kept, you know, what's a good example? He'd be losing it over something and he'd be upset about something, and I'd be saying to her, how do we cope if there's a second child here right now? Like, what would we do? How would we be able to look after him? And I don't get it. And I asked a mate of mine, I said, so is two kids twice as hard as one? And he said, no, it's not. And I said, oh, that's a relief. And he goes, no, it's five times harder. I would have to agree with him so far. It's instead of zero, to go from zero to one was like, it's an intense change and it really rattles you. But it's like, I don't know, you can kind of take it in turns and like you can get out of the house room and the other person looks after the one. But two on one is brutal. So you don't want to leave that person on their own. So it's been really challenging, like unbelievably challenging. In fact, I think nothing's pushed our relationship harder than this has, having two kids. Nothing's challenged our relationship more than this has. But like last night, seeing them cuddle in bed together was like, you know, that's the greatest thing I've ever seen. So it's ups and downs, smiles and frowns is how I describe it.
I'm really keen to circle back to some of those moments you just started to describe. Before we do that, I'm interested to learn from you, Hugh. What roles do you feel like you currently play in life?
Oh, that's a great question. I think Dad is probably... Yeah, I think Dad is the one that is my priority, but it's also the one that I find the most fatiguing. So it's the one I think I struggle at probably the most. So I think you'd know that feeling of, like, a mate of mine called it parenting fatigue. Like, you know, I run a lot. I run heaps, and that makes me tired, but I'm never, like, absolutely exhausted where I can't walk. I work really hard with this Resilience Project. I do 2 or 3 presentations a day, and you know, that's pretty intense. I get tired, but I never lie down going, I can't do this. Like, there was a moment last night when I got the kids to bed, well, I thought I had a bed to get up, and I was lying on the floor of the lounge room, just like, I was like, I can't, he said, quickly, by dinosaurs. And I was like, I can't, I actually can't move. I'm so tired. So my number one, so dad is definitely one of the roles, but I find that very fatiguing and trying very hard at the best that I can, but I'm finding it challenging. I suppose, I don't know how you describe my work role. Like, I think people say that I'm like I run the resilience project. I actually don't run the resilience project. There's a guy called Ben, who's also a dad of two kids, who's our general manager. He runs the organisation. I just go and talk wherever he tells me to talk, basically. So I guess my other role is as a presenter. I present information to people. I'm a son and a brother. They're the other ones. I'm probably very aware of being a son right now. Like my mum and dad are in their early 70s and just with what's going on around the world, I feel very, how to describe it, I'm just very aware of how lucky I am to have both my parents alive, but also quite fearful for what the world's doing right now. So I'm very, I'm FaceTiming them nearly twice a day at the moment, so I can see their grandkids and I can see them. And so I think son is probably the other one that I probably wouldn't have said that, 6 months ago, but certainly son is one of the roles I play now, definitely.
How much, you mentioned what's going on around the world now, how much time have your parents spent with Elsie, only being 6 months old?
Yeah, good question. Well, it's funny you ask that. So Elsie was born on the 29th of January.
Parenting fatigue, it's okay.
I couldn't think it was January or February. It was January. My mum got shingles in February. So mum met Elsie and then they drove up to see her the next day. They lived down in Mornington Peninsula. They drove back up to see her the next day when she was a day old. And then soon after that, mum got shingles in her left ear. I didn't know you got it from a certain place. Your body's in her left ear. It was quite bad for mum. So she had to isolate in February because you can't be around a baby and you got shingles. And so she was isolating for like 6 weeks. She gets out of that. So I don't know, probably a week, and then she gets a week of seeing Elsie, and then we go into lockdown because she's in her early 70s and she's just had this course of steroids. I think it was steroids for years. Anyway, but she was really vulnerable, so she had to stay at home. I would say she's actually seen Elsie in the flesh, which is really sad when you consider they only live an hour away, maybe 4 or 5 times. And my mum's obsessed. My mum's so obsessed with her grandkids. And my brother Josh had a baby 6 days after we had Elsie. My brother had his first son, or his first child, Charlie, a beautiful, beautiful boy with hair that is just honestly like, he's got his hair's like this long and he's only like 5 months old.
Flowing locks.
Yeah, yeah. But mum probably only seen him, a handful of times as well. So they're finding it really hard. And I know mum and dad just want to be, or mum especially, she just wanted to be a grandma. Like from the very, she just wanted to be a grandma. And I've felt that pressure for a long time. And now, such a strange situation. She actually literally is not allowed to see her grandkids. And I know mum's not the only one, but I know a lot of grandparents are really struggling with that. And like we, like the parents, we're struggling as well because we rely on that support so heavily. And I didn't realise how much we rely, how important it was. So yeah, I'm sort of battling with that a bit now.
It's become so like prominent, hasn't it? That support, yep, you're talking about around that little community, that little network that we have around a child, especially nowadays when mum and dad, both parents, dad and dad, mum and mum are usually both working, whether it's in business, whether it's, yeah, just as an employee, it's huge now. And you really got me thinking in terms of how special I'm sure it will be once you can all get together again in that way, whether it is Christmas, whether it is next year, the year after, yeah, it's going to be even more special with Josh, your brother as well, yeah, and his child.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I know I'm not alone in saying this, but like it's funny as a parent, I don't think I've ever taken my parents for granted, but the support they offer you now, like even just being able to, once a week or once every couple of weeks, Penny and I would go out to a pub for dinner and either her parents or my parents would just pop over and look after the kids. Like, and you would have, say that was a Friday night, on Thursday and Friday, you'd look forward to that and you'd go, oh, Friday night we get out together, that'd be good. So you put your head down, you do the hard work with the kids and you go, it's okay, tomorrow night we get to have a few beers and just relax and that's going to be nice. But that doesn't happen anymore. Like it's such a strange situation to be in. And it's, I think that could be one of, like, it's sometimes all you need is one night out over a couple of weeks just to go and have dinner together, just to kind of reset and talk about how you're going and sort of check in with each other. Because you can't even really check in at the moment, like, because, like, what's the example this morning? Benji refused to put his jacket on. Elsie was crying. Benji was refusing to put his jacket on. And I'm chasing him around the lounge room trying to get his jacket on to get him to childcare. And Penny's like, I can see she's a bit stressed with Elsie crying. You can't exactly go, hey, how are you going? Like, how are you traveling on? You just can't, like, you're in it. Like, you're in it. It's a war zone. You can't just stop and, like, have a chat in a war zone about how you're traveling. Like, you're, like, you're at war. You're like, so, but when you know you've got the next night to stop and just go, let's go out for dinner tomorrow. We'll talk about tomorrow night. It just doesn't happen anymore. So, totally. It's a very, very strange time to be alive.
Finding those moments to simply be become few and far between, I found since becoming a parent. And in another way, I also value those moments a lot more now. And it's interesting, just flowing on from that question around what roles do you currently play, having that grandparent support or that support from other people can be so pivotal to the roles that we play. Because I found just in terms of this journey, a lot of parents talking about through this time, right now they feel like they're 100% identifying with one role in their lives. Usually it might be parent, it might be a business owner, employee, whatever it might be. And that usually inevitably leads to neglect of other roles, whether that be life partner, whether that be son, whether that be brother, sister, best mate, whatever it might be, which can have that impact that you're talking about right now as well.
Yeah, totally. Well, I didn't even say husband is one of my roles. Like, that's which is a glaring omission, but, like, that's a huge thing right now. I think when I say dad, when I said dad, or I think I sort of think as parent, the two of us in it together, but yeah, husband's that's really a big one as well.
Yeah, but in this time that they can become so blended, which makes a lot of sense as well. I'm interested to go back in time a little bit and can you tell us about the story behind the moment you found out you were going to be a dad for the first time, Hugh?
Yeah, so it's I'll take you back even further than that to when I decided that I wanted to become a dad. Was, I mean, I've always wanted to be a dad. I was all my mates from school, so I'm 40 now, all my mates from school have got kids who are at primary school, or they're a couple of them are starting secondary school. So my mates got going a lot earlier than I did. And I was, you know, a lot of them married girls from school, girls who actually went to school, which is quite interesting, but which is great. I sort of didn't quite find my, well, partner for quite some time. I met Penny probably when I was 35. So, but I was, she wanted to go and live in New York and work in New York for a couple of years. And I was really open to that and thought, I was like, ideally, I'd love to have kids before we do that. But like, if it's, you know, she was a lot younger, she's 9 years younger. So, you know, I was like, I don't want to take away your early 30 years just because I want to have kids. Like, so that's fine. And I was playing cricket. I used to play a lot of cricket. I was playing cricket and my dad came to watch, and I saw him get out of his, and my dad has come to watch me ever since, you know, I was a kid. I played every Saturday from the age of 5 to 35 basically, and I'd been out injured for a year. I snapped my I snapped my hamstring off the bone. It was pretty bad. I had surgery, and so I hadn't played in about a year, and I was playing again. I was playing a game, and I saw this guy, and Dad won't listen to this. He doesn't have a podcast, so I can say this. I saw this guy walking around the ground, this quite elderly-looking man, and he was sort of struggling a bit to walk down this hill, this slope near the boundary line, and I was watching him, and I looked and I thought, oh, my God, that's Dad. And he just looked so much older, and I realised that Dad is a much older man now. He would have been, back then, he would have been late 60s. And I just thought, shit, Dad's old. And I just got a bit panicky and thought, I just, the first thought I had was really bizarre. I was standing there playing cricket, I'm over the field and I'm going, I really want Dad. I want my kids to meet their granddad. Like, my dad is the best man I've met in my entire life. Like, he's honestly the most beautiful man, like the sweetest, loveliest, most loving, caring, is just amazing. And I was thinking, I can't handle the thought of my kids not meeting their grandpa. And you're not meeting their grandpa, my dad. So I went home from cricket. I said to Penny, this is a bit of a weird one. And I got really emotional telling her. And I said, I explained why I wanted to have kids now and not go to New York. And she's pretty amazing. She said, all right, yep, that I understand that. I'm shouting because I want to go to New York. But as long as you promise me we can go and live in New York with the kids when they're a bit older. And I said, yeah, done. And so anyway, fast forward a bit of time. We said, yeah, okay, we'll try to have kids. Without giving too much of the ins and outs of it, it didn't take too long. But we were so much so that I was very shocked when we discovered we were going to the football, the MCG. We're going to watch Hawthorn Geelong? No, it was Hawthorn Essendon at the MCG. I think it was an early season game. It was like in April, and we were going with two of our really good mates, Joe and Christian, two of our best mates, a lovely couple. We got there, and Reedy Jared said to me, oh, do you want a beer? I said, yeah, I love one. He said, Penny, do you want a beer? She goes, no, I'm fine. And Penny and I just love having a few beers together on Friday night. We always have. Like, it's just been a thing. Just have two or three pints and that's it. Anyway, she says, no, I'm right. And then he said, what do you mean? And I said, yeah, what do you mean? And she goes, I just don't feel like it. And I said, why? And she goes, I just don't want to. And I went, oh, fair enough. And then she goes, oh, I'm going to go to the bathroom. I said, okay. And she goes, do you want to come with me? And I said, what? And she goes, just come with me. I went, oh, you're right. She goes, no, I need you to come with me. And I went, is everything all right? She goes, just come with me. We walked around. We're at the MCG members. She takes me around the back of the MCC stand. It's just in front of where the toilets are. And she goes, put your hands out. I put my hand out. And she put the pregnancy test in my hand. And I just didn't click what it was. I went, what's this? And she goes, look what it says. And I was like, oh, my, what? Oh, and so that's how I found out the first time. So,
wow.
So we sat there watching the first half of football. I'm a Hawthorn supporter. I didn't concentrate on – I didn't even know what was going. I was just sitting there blankly, and Reedy kept going, do you want another beer, and trying to prompt me that it was my shout. And I was going, no. And I was just staring at the footy going, oh, my God, this is massive. And I kept looking at Penny. We couldn't concentrate. And then at halftime, it was just before halftime, I said to Penny, do you want to go? And she goes, yeah. I said, I don't really feel like being here. I want to talk about it. So she goes, yeah, cool. And so I said to Reedy, I said, mate, this is weird, and I'll explain to you, and Kristen, I'll explain to you guys in a few months, but we need to go. And they went, is everything okay? And I went, yeah, everything's fine. We just have to go. I'll explain in a few months. So, and we went home and just, oh, yeah. So that's how I found out.
Wow. That would have been odd for your best mate. Probably a packed house at the G, leaving it at halftime.
Wow. Totally, yeah.
Talk about defining moments. That's something I've been thinking a lot about lately. And just that moment you described before of playing cricket and seeing your dad.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, he doesn't listen to podcasts. I just want to acknowledge you for sharing that, because I reckon that's a beautiful sort of moment to describe. And I'm not sure if you've ever told him that or mentioned that to him. But it's something that, I think is awesome and amazing that it sort of just came about. Like it wasn't caused by anything major. It just happened.
Yeah, it's a funny one. I mean, I even remember when I found out that Benji was a boy. Like, we were, because we found out with both Benji and Elsie if it was a boy or a girl. Did you guys do it, or did you have a surprise?
Yeah, we went through that harmony test, I think.
Oh,
it's
right.
Called.
Yeah. How old is your son, is it?
Oscar, yeah. Oscar is 2 years, 9 months. He's actually, he was born a few days before Richmond won that drought-breaking flag. So he's an honorary Richmond fan now. So, 29th of September, he turns 3.
Oh, wow. How exciting.
Yeah, have you found the twos? Fan. Hey?
How have you found the twos? The terrible twos. Have they been all right? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you've definitely caught me in a little phase of we were running around after him this morning as well, trying to get him ready for daycare. So I definitely feel some empathy for you. I feel that little bit of pain, but he's definitely very emotional. I think he's like his dad in that way, like in terms of just being open to being emotional as well. Yeah. And daycare, they talk about him being emotional. His grandparents talk about him being emotional, but to be honest, yeah, those moments of tantrums or whatever, they sort of, to me, they've just sort of fade away pretty quickly. Like the moments of, yeah, like mucking around, playing some footy with him or reading a book. Like my favorite moment right now is when we both get home from work, we've picked Oscar up. I'll literally, like, I'll only have to touch a footy, like pick it up, and he'll just come through with the big shoulder charger straight away, and it's all on there. It's like I reckon they need it. I don't know if you found it with Benji, but they need that physical sort of contact, that wrestling, that mucking around, whether it be with dad or mum. It's something that I really enjoy at the moment, actually, which I never really thought about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say about him being really emotional and people mentioning it. But we were a bit concerned with our son being a bit emotional. We actually went and saw a child psychologist who's a very good friend of mine. She's an incredible woman, Dr. Caroline Clifford. A great, amazing child psychologist. And she said, what they're doing is they're expressing their emotions. They're not keeping them inside. And that's a really, really healthy thing. So we all have these emotions. We all have emotional ups and downs and highs and lows throughout our lives. And at a young age, it's tiring for the parents. It's exhausting for the parents when the kids are expressing it so much, when they don't know how to express it. But it's a really healthy thing that they're not, you know, anything that causes them to feel anxious or worried, if it comes out in anger or if it comes out in tantrums, or that's them expressing it, and it's a really healthy thing. So, which I found unbelievably helpful to understand. And it also helped me deal with it a lot better. Penny was reading a book the other day. I forgot what it's called because I'm so tired. But she said, it was like when your kids have a tantrum, when they're losing really and they're really upset about something, the best way to deal with it is to not just get down to their level, but below them. So actually sit on the ground in the least threatening position. So legs crossed on the ground right in front of them and say, "Hey, what's going on? Are you okay?" And I said, "Oh, okay." She said it when we're going to bed. And I went, "Oh, that's really interesting." And the next morning, Benji absolutely lost it about something. Well, that's right. I gave him some food and he threw it on the ground. And my first reaction was to like get angry at him, like that's not on. But I looked at Penny and smiled, and I sat down on the ground straight away, crossed my legs. And also, it was a bit facetious the way I said it, but to make her laugh, I said, "What's going on, mate? Are you okay? What just happened there?" Honestly, he was totally, he goes, "I'm okay. Sorry, Daddy." And he started helping me pick it up. Like, I was like, "Oh, whoa, that's unbelievable." It was incredible how quickly, and it kind of makes sense, right? Like if you or I were extremely upset about something, extremely angry, and someone said to us, "Don't be like that, stop being like that," and pointed down at us and were quite threatening to us, it'd just make us get more worked up. But if we're in that really heightened, angry, emotional state where things are out of control for us and we're about to lose it, and someone in a really non-threatening way says, "Hey, what's going on? Like, how can I help you?" It would bring your emotions back down really quickly. I don't know, I'm way off topic here. But,
no, that is awesome.
I just think it's a really helpful really thing cool. to generally put yourself in their shoes and go, well, he's got no cognitive capacity here. He's lost it. Like, he's absolutely lost his marbles, yelling and screaming and trying to scare him into behaving. Like, that's just, it's ludicrous. It's not going to work. But if you come at them from a really like, "Mate, I'm here. What's going on? Like, talk to me. How can I make this better for you?" That's how we'd want to be treated. So I don't know why and so far for me, I mean, who knows, in a couple of weeks, he might be throwing food on me when I'm sitting on the ground. But so far, it's been really, really powerful.
That is cool.
It is. But I skipped up. I want to tell you the story about when I found out that we were having a boy. I had been doing work at, I was in Seaford because I've been doing work at St Kilda Footy Club. I'd done a series of presentations to the St Kilda boys back in I'd left St Kilda Football Club and Penny called me and she said, "I've just had the whatever test it is." And she said, "I actually know if we're having a boy or a girl." And I went, "What do you mean?" And she goes, "Well, the lady just told me, so I know." And I went, "Oh my gosh." And I'd wanted a girl first, and then last minute I was like, "No, I want a boy. Actually, I really want a boy." But hang on, I'm going to pull over the side of the road. So I pulled over the side of the road. And I sat there and I was like, this is a massive moment in my life. Right now, I have no idea if I'm having a boy or a girl. In a minute, I'm going to know if I'm going to be a boy or a girl. And she goes, So we're having a boy. And I started crying straight away. And I would have cried if it was a girl. Like, I would have cried either way. But, yeah, like, just it was the most incredible moment. It was just amazing.
It's beautiful, isn't it, how it just brings that emotion out in you. I recall a similar moment in terms of just, yeah, pure emotion. We actually moved to Broome literally a few weeks after. Yeah, we moved to Broome a few weeks after finding out Jess was pregnant with Oscar.
Are you in Broome now?
No. Oh. We were there for a couple of years. Oscar was born there, so he'll forever be a Broome baby. But we... We moved back down about a year ago now, I think, back down to the family in Perth. But we actually, we drove up there. We did the whole road trip. It was awesome. But when we arrived, Jess was really emotional. I was really emotional because it was our first big move away from family. We found out we were pregnant a few weeks earlier. And I remember, we got the call from the doctor or the nurse at the time. And same thing, we just both just looked at each other and just sobbed for about an hour. In terms of, like, writing all these different emotions, like we're sad that we're away from family, but we're excited where we were, excited we're having a boy, just all those different emotions. But just on, it sort of made me think on the point you made before around the difference of the difference in methods or tactics that you use with Benji now. It's almost like you're talking with him, not at him. And then you made the point of it would be the exact same for us. And it is the same. There are a lot of correlations, if you think about it, between leadership in the workplace, in a team environment, whether it be a sport or not a sport, and just the organization's people. I'm the exact same. If someone talks at me and they're explicit and they're direct, I don't respond as well as if someone asks me a question for my input and wants me to add value to whatever that may be. Again, might be delivered slightly differently, but we've seen that the same with Oscar, just by sitting with him or being with him to be able to for him to know that we're just there. And every now and then, if you want to talk about it, Oscar, we're here. If you want to hug, we're here, but not why are you like this? You should be doing this. You should be doing this. You should be doing this. But that's out there as well. Like it's a part of it.
Yeah, totally. I think what our kids respond to best is us just showing up, really. Like, you just got to show up. There's another book I read the other day, which is the whole book. The premise was about what our kids need for us is just to show up and be there and be authentic. Like, if we're struggling, you know, let them know. If we're, you know, whatever we're feeling, we sort of show up for them. We're there, and we won't get it right all the time. In fact, so often we get it wrong, but that's okay. Like, that's part of life. Like, not everyone's going to get it right with them when they're older. They'll have low moments and moments where they lower their colours a bit, but we're just going to keep showing up for them.
Going from one story of the story behind the moment you found out you were going to be a dad to the story behind the Resilience Project, you've talked about it a little bit, just in terms of maybe for those out there that don't know it, could you tell us a little bit more about that and how that come about?
Yeah, so it's another story about family, I guess. Like, my little sister, when she was, we had a very, very, very happy upbringing. My dad was a dentist who worked very, very hard to give us every opportunity in life. He came out to Australia age 10 from Sri Lanka on a boat, and his parents took a huge gamble moving to Australia to give him every opportunity, and he's always been very driven since that point to give us every opportunity in life. So he worked unbelievably hard as a dentist. He worked from the age of, I think it was 25 to 65, and he missed one day of work sick. That's it, in all those years, which is just, and that's leaving the house at, you know, 7 every morning, getting up at 6 at night, and he missed one day sick, which I just, that's just extraordinary.
Talk about commitment.
Yeah, and that was just his way. He's just such a hard worker, and so, yeah, and mum was a stay-at-home mum with three kids, and we had a very happy upbringing until the point my sister turned 14 and I was 16 and she was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, an eating disorder, and it ravaged the family. I remember very clearly having dinner one night and I had this thought in my head of, we're actually not a happy family anymore. Like, we are no longer a happy family. And I found it very distressing, and And I cared deeply for, and still do, for my little brother Josh, who was 12 at the time. And I was just thinking, God, like, he's just had the security blanket of his family just ripped out from underneath him, age 12. His mum and my sister would fight every single night over food. Dad wasn't so involved in the fights, but I could tell he was very upset about it. And so I, from a young age, was pretty fascinated with, like, what is it that, like, the question I became fascinated with is, well, what do we do to be happy? Like, how can I make mum and dad happy again? And I didn't know, really. I knew they loved when I told them stories. So every dinner table, every night, I'd be telling stories to try and make people laugh, to try and get in before the fight started around food. And, but I honestly didn't find an answer to that question 12 years later. I was 28 years old. I was living in India as a primary school teacher, volunteering up in the Himalayas. And I just lived with this community of people who I still look back on and think they are the happiest people I've ever met in my entire life. And one kid in particular, his name is Stunzen, I was just so drawn to him because, you know, in this community, there's no running water, no electricity. Everyone's sleeping on a dirt floor. There are no beds there. No one can afford a bed. This kid was just this beacon of positivity and joy. And I was only going to be there for a couple of weeks and thought, nah, do you know what? I think I'm going to leave here. I'm going to leave here as long as the tax going to work out. What do these people do every day that makes them so happy? So I ended up living there for about 3 months, a bit more than 3 months, I think it was. And all I wanted to do that whole time was work out what do these people do every day that makes them so happy? And so I discovered there that these people actually stop their day every day and they practice gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, which very conveniently had the acronym GEM. So it's like I discovered this GEM. Well, I didn't discover it. I observed other people doing it. I practiced gratitude, empathy, mindfulness every single day. I joined in, had a profound impact on me, came back to Melbourne, and I wanted to talk. As a primary school teacher, I started embedding these things into my curriculum, just in my classroom. Had a huge impact on my class, and I thought, you know what, I think more people need to hear about this. So I stopped teaching and set up this thing called it didn't even have a name back then. I literally didn't have a name. I was just calling schools going, hi, my name's Hugh, can I come and speak to your kids? And most people said no, which is probably fair enough. I would too if I called out of the blue. It took a while. It was very slow at the start, but, you know, 10 years later now we've got 200,000 kids around the country doing our school curriculum every day, and we're currently doing a program for Coles, which is engaging 120,000 of their staff. And we've got a lot of work with AFL footy clubs, and yeah, kind of pinch myself a bit now when I see the reach that it's got. But it all started with my sister. Well, it's a really important thing to actually acknowledge that, like, you know, hardship, we all go through hardship and it's awful at the time, but it often shapes who we turn into. My little sister now, like, the reason she went through something very traumatic as a kid, as a very young kid, from a complete stranger when she was 3 years old, and that is what led to her having anorexia. But now when I ask her about that event, like I say, I said to her, I wish that never happened to you when you were 3 years old from a complete stranger. And she said, I don't know, I'm being a bit ambiguous here. It's a hard one to talk about with my sister, an assault that she suffered when she was three. But I say to her, it's so awful what happened to you. I wish it never happened. And she said, well, I don't. She said, I'm actually quite grateful for what happened to me, because I wouldn't be doing the incredible stuff I'm doing right now if that hadn't happened to me. And she said, and by the way, you wouldn't be doing the Resilience Project if it wasn't for that incident as well. So, yeah, it was painful at the time, but let's not forget that it's shaped us into the people we are now. So, you know, it all started from a really traumatic event. However, that traumatic event has shaped me and my sister enormously, and I can never really forget that, I suppose.
That's beautiful, Hugh. I just want to acknowledge you for sharing that as well, and the way that your sister and now yourself as well have been able to attach a different meaning to that story, to rewrite that story in a way which, by the sounds of it, is underpinned by gratitude.
Yeah,
which totally. Is coming through loud and clear. How do you feel right now in this moment, reflecting back on this journey you've been on so far?
Really proud of my sister, very proud of my sister, and also, I suppose, quite proud that quite proud of what we've managed to achieve with the Resilience Project. It's been a hell of a journey, you know. Hell of a journey, but it's Yeah, I think pride is the main thing I feel for my sister getting through what she's got through.
Time for a short reflection break. This is an opportunity for you to stop, take a breath, and reflect on your past week as a parent. If you have a pen and paper near you, that's great. If not, simply use your phone or laptop. I want you to write down three things. First, write down one moment in the past week that you were proud of yourself as a parent. Second, write down one area of your parenting that you would like to improve for the next week. Third, write down one moment from the past week where your child or children have made you smile. Be kind to yourself and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
What does resilience mean to you?
So for me, it's resilience is when you're able to, your standard definition is the ability to bounce back. You know, I heard a psychologist once say it's the ability to bungee jump through the pitfalls of life, which I really like. I think it's the times that we need to be resilient really fascinating me. Like this morning, like my wife was getting ready to go and walk the dog. She needed resilience then because she had Elsie strapped to her chest, but Elsie was screaming. She couldn't find the dog's lead. Benji was saying he wanted to go with her, but he had to stay with me. She forgot her mask when she walked out the door, came back and was like, "Oh, that's right." And she dropped her phone amongst it all. And I was like, you could see she's on the edge. She's just about to lose it, but she didn't. So like she's being resilient there. But then there's also stuff like, you know, I turn around and I'm watching the news and there's a guy talking about his mum dying in one of the aged care facilities in Melbourne. And how he didn't get to say goodbye to her, and no one in the family got to say goodbye to her. And then there's that kind of resilience, which is like, you know, trying to bounce back from something which is completely life changing and completely life shattering. And so we need it all the time, varying levels. It's just, it's bouncing back. My wife took probably 5 seconds to bounce back from what happened to her today. And the poor guy saw on the news this morning talking about his mum. It's going to take a long time if you ever bounce back from something like that. So, yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that really interests me in the parenting sense as well, because flowing on from resilience in general to challenges that you faced as a parent, and I say challenges because that's where I see resilience most prominent, is when it may be an individual, it may be a group of people, like you said, that is when resilience is possible. And I'm interested to know what challenges have you faced in your parenthood journey so far?
Well, it's a thing I've found most challenging in my life, being a parent. Like, that's what I've needed my resilience for the most. And I almost feel silly that for 8 years I ran around the country doing parent talks, like how to parent, and I wasn't a parent. Like, I know people enjoyed the talks, but I look back and go, what did I know back then? Like, I didn't understand how hard it really was. But that's funny. Like, we're actually trying to teach Benji resilience at the moment, because I've noticed if he can't do something, he's not interested. Like, if he can't, we got him a scooter and he saw other kids doing it and he stood on it and just got so upset, and whenever he saw it, he'd just kick it over and just get really upset. And so, or when we were playing football, if the kick wasn't perfect every time, he'd get really upset. And so we're having these long conversations about, like, or if he'd fall over, he'd get so upset and not get up for ages. So we've had these long conversations about, well, Penny's been doing a great job, because we were on his scooter the other day and he sort of wobbled a bit. And when he was about to fall over, I thought, oh, here we go. And then I said, oh, well done, you kept going. He said, yeah, Mummy says when you fall over, you have to get up and keep going. So he's like listening and he's trying, he understands, like, when we play football together, when he falls over, he used to cry and just lie on the floor for ages and not want to get up. And now I pretend I'm a commentator and like, oh, he's down. He won't be able to get up here. There's no way. He's way too sore. He can't get up. He's injured. He's going to have to lie down for the rest of the game. And like, and then the one time he got up, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. This guy's unbelievable. He got up. He's not hurt. And he had the biggest smile on his face. And so now he actually falls over on purpose so I can commentate and pretend he's injured. Yeah. So we're actually teaching him, but it's funny, like we're literally teaching him every day at the moment about resilience. But The things I need resilience for most are, like this morning, it was I reckon probably 3 or 4 hours sleep last night, and then I had to get up. Well, two mornings ago, I got up and I think my microphone has just changed, mate. Sorry, I'm just going to fix the microphone here. Is that going a bit quiet?
No, I can still hear you loud and clear. That's cool.
Oh, right. Okay. I thought it had changed. So,
That's right.
Yeah. So yesterday morning, I had a great sleep and I woke up and I was like so bubbly, so enthusiastic, so positive. I'm doing all this like where like I was playing the funnest game. We've invented this really fun game called Rapid Fire with Benji, where I just literally got every pillow in the house and he had to run up and down the hall and I'd just throw it at him as he was going up and down. And we just had the best time and I went to work in such a good mood. I got no sleep last night and I got up and like Penny's trying to deal with Elsie crying and Benji goes, let's play Rapid Fire again. Nah, I don't have the energy today. And he goes, I've got the pillows, we play Rapid Fire. And I just couldn't, like, I just had no energy. I was so exhausted. And I was like, well, I'm projecting my lack of sleep on him. Like, he's confused about why we're not doing it. We did it yesterday. It was so much fun. Why wouldn't we do it again today? Have I done something? And he was really upset that we wouldn't play it. And so it's just stuff like that. It's just everyday stuff. It's just the constant. I need resilience for the constant. Like, you never really escape it. It's like, you know, it's hard at night. You go through, like, last night I couldn't get him to sleep. And then we're back at it again, like 6:30 this morning. It's just, it's relentless, which everyone knows, but I think that's what I need resilience for the most.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you think we, just in what you see in what you do for work and with the Resilience Project, do you think we celebrate our own resilience enough?
Definitely not. So it's just a really good point. We should be celebrating with our partner or whatever, or with the people in our lives. We should be celebrating the small things as well. I've already thought to myself, when I get home tonight, it's funny you start asking that question, I'm going to make a big deal to Penny about how I thought she did so well not to lose it.
Because that's awesome, man. That's wicked.
Because I reckon I probably would have. What did I lose about the other night? That's right. I was, I don't even know why this got to me so much, but I'd been to the shops. I bought all these almonds. I'm trying to eat really healthy at the moment. I have these almonds and it was about 9 o'clock at night and I just had them in a bag. Like, I had them wrapped up in the bag and Penny had seen them and she'd gone and put them in a Tupperware container for me, which is a nice thing to do, like just to keep it a bit fresher. But the Tupperware container she'd got for me had like, it'd been through the washing machine or through the dishwasher, so it's kind of shrunk a bit. So the lid wasn't fitting properly and I couldn't get the lid off. And I said something like, why did you put them in here? Like, she goes, just so to be fresher. And I went, well, I can't get it off now. And I was like, I was losing it, so I couldn't get a lid off the almonds. Like, the next morning, I said, I really got angry last night about the almonds. And she goes, yeah, you really did. And so that's why I was thinking today, like, Penny could have lost it so easily about the whole saga, but she didn't. So I need to make a big deal of that. So I think we should be, it should be like, you know, in cricket when people get a wicket and you see the celebration, they run around high-fiving, just hugging and stuff. I think we should do the same like day-to-day around the house. If like someone does something really resilient, you should go, yes. Run around high-fiving and like, just like cheering, like just taking a wicket. I feel like that'd be like a, because it happens, it's like a wicket in cricket, it happens every few hours. Like, it's a build-up and a build-up. Yeah, we did it. Well done. It should be the same.
Working together. I love that, man. Like, there's some method in the madness, I think. I've been reading it a bit lately just on, like, organizational culture and that sort of thing. And I read this story on Google, actually, talking about just random celebrations. And one of their many quirky qualities was they literally, like, anyone from the intern right up to senior executives would have the right mid meeting when whatever they were talking about just to burst into a massive clap. They just started bursting into this massive clap and it just lifts the energy. And you're right, whether it's cricket, whether it's at home, like just being able to change your state through some physiology, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Like, it can be such a big thing. But yeah, I'm on the same page. I don't think we celebrate we don't celebrate our progress enough and our resilience enough day to day, because, and whether that's because we don't recognize it in the first place, which I don't think is true. I think we always, like you said, we in the moment we're like, oh, that person, I admire what that person has done there, but we quickly get lost in the next thing that we are doing and the whole blur of day to day. But
yeah,
it's totally.
We even like on that topic, every Boxing Day, me and my best mates from school go to the Boxing Day test for breakfast beforehand. It's a tradition. We go to breakfast and we watch the whole game together. And it's like we meet at 6:30, 6:45 every morning, every Boxing Day morning. And for a lot of us, it's the only time we see each other all year. Like there's 10 of us, all got families now. And last year we were gathering it. It's usually like we see something, go, g'day, how are you going? Shake hands. And like, but last year, like someone just was, I don't know who started it, like just massive high fives and hugging, and then like everyone's hugging, high fiving. And someone said, it's like we're just taking a wicket. And I felt like we were all celebrating like the fact we just got through the year. Like we all say it's our favorite day of the year. We're all just like on Christmas Day, we're going, it's nearly there. And so I felt like we'd all, but it was just something about that rest of the morning. We were on such a high because we'd just all been like hugging, high five, just like a celebration. And it was like, we've all had a tough year. We don't know why. We're not in each other's lives as much as we'd like to be, but we got through it.
That's really cool. It's cool that you've still got that tradition going.
Yeah, it's a guy I went to school called Andrew Kent, who's very good at cricket. He was captain of Melbourne Cricket Club for a long time. So he gets a table at the breakfast and we call it Kent's 11. There's 11 of us who all get together. We look a lot older now. We don't last as long as we used to.
Is anyone still rolling the arm over?
No, I think we're all done. Yeah, we're all done. We're all done. I think I was the last. No, Andrew Kent was actually the last one to retire. But yeah, we're all done. But yeah, we used to talk about resilience. We used to start at 6:30 in the morning and finish at midnight or 2 in the morning. We're all now lucky if we can make it through to the last ball of the day.
They're big days, aren't they?
Oh, massive. Good days, but they're taxing.
Yeah. I mean, we're pretty lucky over here in Perth now. We've got a beautiful Optus or Perth Stadium.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more comfortable than the Wacker, being on that grass bank all day, nice and sticky. You got your sunscreen. You've just got, you're probably into the 70th over of the day and you're in absolute, you're like a dried up piece of fruit, I reckon, half the time. It's like, it's one of the coolest experiences though. Just that Australian sport experience. I love it.
Oh, but
I'm keen to learn a little bit more about what you see, across the landscape, whether it's, through the Resilience Project in terms of schools, like you said, the parenting workshops that you've done, corporate. Are you noticing any challenges out there broadly from a parenting point of view that have started to pop up? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's been around for a while, but the challenge of devices is a really big one for parents at the moment. Like, that's a challenge we're having at the moment I realised I've been running around the country telling people to get off their phones and make sure their kids aren't on the phones, but then I was out for breakfast with Benji last year and I had the newspaper in front of us. And he was on my lap and he tried to swipe a picture in the newspaper, tried to swipe it. And I thought, oh my God, like I'm not practicing what I preach here. So it's finding a balance between like that addiction to screen. Like it's so good to give yourself a bit of time with your partner, just a bit of downtime when they're on the phone, but they're just missing. So I mean, I'm not about you, but I'm so glad I grew up before social media and devices, because like I see families out for dinner. Well, I used to see families out for dinner and there's three kids on the device. There's no conversation happening. I look back on like going out for dinner with the family when I was a kid, didn't happen much. And when it did, it was the greatest thing ever. And it was just felt so excited to be there with mum and dad, just talking about stuff and talking about our day and talking about, you know, we would go to La Porchetta, and I remember going to La Porchetta in Melbourne, a pizza and a pasta restaurant. And
it's
my favorite
place.
Yeah, it's like, how lucky am I to be doing this? And we're just chatting and talking about, we're all in primary school. My brother had just started prep and I was in grade 6. And I just remember the best conversations. Like, when I go out now and I see kids staring at a screen, they're missing, so I learned so much about socialization and learning social skills from watching my mum and dad, you know. And I had a doctor tell me the other day that he was at a restaurant and he saw this lady trying to get into the restaurant with a double pram. And he said, I looked up and there was a table right next to the door and there were three kids sitting there with their family, all three of them just on their phones. And he said, they missed the opportunity to see this woman struggling, help her, like the kids to do it, to help her. And then have the woman say, thank you, that's so nice, we really appreciate that. So they'd go, oh, that felt really good. Helping someone felt good. I need to look out for opportunities to do that again because that's a really nice thing to do. The dad was there on his phone. The mum was really not paying attention. He said, it's just like, he said, it made me really sad, like, because that's how you learn your face. That's how you learn to be a good person, by having experiences in the world, but the kids aren't having these experiences. The other obvious one is that kids aren't learning how to treat each other properly because they're saying things to each other online that you would never say to someone's face, because a kid might say something when we're young, we don't mean to be, we're sort of working out how to communicate with other people. And as a young kid, you might say something like, you're ugly, or you're fat, or something, or, and then you'll see how it makes the other person feel. You see their response and you go, oh geez, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to hurt that person like that. That's not a good thing to do. But when they do it, when they just send it as a message or they post it to someone or however they're communicating it, they don't see the impact it has on the other person. So there's no feedback there. So there's a statistic going around that the average, what is it? It's the adolescent brain receives the same amount of information in a week that our brain is used to receive in a whole year. So they're being inundated with information, absolutely smashed and inundated with information. So yeah, it's just something to be wary of, I think, that the kids are on the screens too much. I'm not saying they never use it, but we need to be much better.
It's almost become that default in terms of any pressure situation or whatever it might be, just withdraw back to that, with inside that bubble, that force field, which at the end of the day, it's like that becomes a comfort zone in a way to stay within that. It's interesting you mentioned, because we need to be able to use it for so many different things now. Like, I mean, we're having this conversation obviously over Zoom, and it's interesting you mentioned there needs to be a way to educate young people coming through on how it can be used in a beneficial way, a positive way to still contribute and serve others, but also be able to find a way to educate them on the negative impacts. And I think that's happening more and more, but we're smack bang in the middle of that still. We're probably in the infancy of it, because it's been 20, 30 years, like, and this has just absolutely exploded. And 20, 30 years is the blink of an eye in when you're talking humanity. So, I mean, something that I've been sort of thinking about a bit lately, and we've talked about it before, is a concept I call the blend of consumption with creation. So, I mean, you've got creation, which to me can be very beneficial to that young person's development, can be beneficial to others. And that could be as simple as drawing with the iPad, or painting, or they might be writing a story about the day that they've had, or starting to practice some journaling with technology, or it could even be taking photos of nature or whatever it might be. But being able to really maximize that time and encourage that time, because it's still a sense of creation, but then being able to blend that with consumption, because we all know that it's never going to be zero consumption. And when I say consumption, you're talking your shows, your movies, whatever it might be, some YouTube stuff, like, because that is all out there now and it's not going away. But that's something I've been thinking a lot about with Oscar, being 2 years old, and he's the same. He's already trying to unlock devices and that. And it's not like we've walked him through and said, this is how you do it. It's just from watching only us, but everyone around him too. So finding that blend between creation and consumption is something we're focusing on at the moment. And I suppose, the proof will be in the pudding down the track in terms of what we see him using it for. But it's one of those ongoing challenges, I think.
It is. It's a great question to be asking, like, that creation versus consumption, because I find that the biggest issue for me is kids are never bored anymore. And, like, we're meant to be bored, because when you're bored, that's when you learn to be creative. And I feel like if they're never bored, then what's prompting them to be creative? So I think it's a really good question to ask.
For sure. Yeah, that topic of boredom, that's something that really interests me as well, because I think you're totally right. And it's something I heard the other day. Her name's Dr. Vanessa Lapointe. She's a child psychologist from, I'm going to say, over in the US. And I watched a fair bit of her content and books for a while now. And she talks about that boredom is the key component to developing a sense of self, very similar to what you said there, just around that time for them to be able to just explore who they are, what they want to do, what they want to be. And it can be really small, but it all builds up in those incremental sort of steps to really sort of getting a clearer picture of who they are as a person and where they want to go. And a big component to all of that, though, I think, Hugh, is at the end of the day, when a kid comes to you and says they're bored, there seems to be a real knee-jerk reaction of trying to find something for them to do straight away, if you know what I mean. Like, as a parent, Oscar or whoever comes to me and I'm really bored. And it's like there's this sort of common approach out there of, okay, let's find something to fix that boredom. And like being able to flip that and just be like, that's okay. Like it's okay to be bored or whatever. It's something, that really interests me.
It's a great episode in Bluey of Bingo not having anyone to play with, and the mum saying you play by herself, so I can't. And then she works out she needs a problem to solve, and that's what the boredom leads her to, is like, what's a problem I could solve? And it's a great look at that whole concept of boredom. Really good.
So many lessons in that show, isn't there? I'll be honest, I've got stuck many a time watching an episode or two of Bluey, and they're bringing out better and better ones all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's take a sharp left now out of the challenges, and what are some of the biggest parenting joys that come to mind for you, Hugh?
Just pay attention to time right now, because I'm about to break the script for a second. I'm about to get kicked out of the studio in a couple of minutes, so I just got to let you know. So what was the question? What are the biggest challenges?
Some of the biggest parenting joys that come to mind.
Hang on, I'm just going to check on it. Hey, sorry, do you mind if I check if I need the studio now or later?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Is it, so you're in here? Okay, give you 2 minutes. No, it's telephone. Telephone. Sorry, mate. Sorry, Sean.
That's okay. Did you need to wrap up soon?
Well, I do in a couple of minutes. Sorry. The studio is booked for 8:30 and I've got to set up for Prezzo. Sorry.
Yeah. Too easy.
So the biggest joys as a parent?
Yeah. Biggest joys that come to mind for you as a parent?
The biggest joys that come to mind for me as a parent at the moment is when I see the two kids interact with each other, and it's very minimal. And I don't think Elsie knows she's doing it because she's only 6 months old, but like last night I wedged her in the couch between myself and Benji, and she just kept looking at him and looking at him, and he was giggling that she wouldn't stop looking at him. And I think that was really amazing. So that's probably the biggest joy in interaction. But it's a whole lot of things, but I think that's the main one for me, is when they interact with each other. And I've been told that it just gets better and better and better, and then it gets worse because they fight a lot. But I think for now, it's seeing them, their interactions, whilst they're minimal, are so incredible. But then also the other joy is seeing Benji do things for us. Like, he's starting to understand that he can help us do things. And when he goes and gets stuff for us, or wants to help put Elsie down, that is just unbelievable. But his smile, their smiles are probably the biggest joy.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Just to wrap up with one final question, you've been effing with your time. I'm interested to go back in time with you again, just quickly. And if you could transport back in time with one piece of advice for your pre-parent self, what would that one piece of advice be?
Very, very simple. The advice would be that you are enough. Like, as you are right now, you are worthy of love and affection. You don't need to have an amazing job. You don't need to be playing the first 11 cricket team. You don't need to be the funniest person. You don't need to be telling stories all the time. You don't need to be making everyone else happy. You're enough. Like, as you are, just calm down a bit. Just, you're enough. You don't need everyone's approval. You're enough. And I wish I'd been told that when I was a lot younger.
Oh, it's better knowing it now than never.
Totally.
That's epic. I love your work here. I just want to send well wishes across to yourself, Penny, Benji, and Elsie, and look forward to some more chats in the future.
I do plenty of these chats, John, I have to say, but I absolutely love this one. So thank you so much. You've asked some really great questions that have actually got me thinking a lot. So thank you.
I'm always here to chat. Thank you, Hugh. I'll chat to you soon.
Thank you for listening. Let us know if anything stood out for you during the chat. As the new pod on the block, it would be awesome if you look out for us and share this episode with someone that you think may be interested. While you're at it, why not head to our socials and share some love with a like, follow, or comment? Keep an eye out for the next pod drop. Big thanks to Stilo Media for producing this piece of art we call Sounding Board Parenting. From our hearts to yours, we hope you're making progress on something that you love and makes you feel alive. Remember, this can go anywhere.